And so you see this also in you know, in cases where you've got a very busy professional working really hard at a job that isn't bringing her very much satisfaction. And, you know, she's a multitasker and she's got kids. And instead of encouraging her to look at, well, is this really how you want to live your life? Do you have to live your life this way? The impetus at this point, the momentum, is toward prescribing her Prozac. Now, there's nothing wrong with raising her set point. But on the other hand, if that's what she's told is the solution to her problem, then why should she look anywhere? And she feels a little bit better. Why should mm-hmm. she look anywhere else when, in fact, this whole business of, you know, everybody being demanded to work 24 hours a day with their BlackBerries and their cell phones and their...
Well, you know, I actually thought about the same thing with modafinil. I mean, I'm a total advocate of decriminalization of drugs and that people should have right to as long as they're safe, and modafinil seems to be overwhelmingly safe compared to a lot of things that we do, that you should be able to use it. But on the other hand, one of the recent decisions of the FDA vis-a-vis modafinil was that it could be prescribed for truckers who had to drive all night and for people who had late shift jobs. Now, on the other one hand, I don't want a trucker behind me to be sleepy on the road. And so, you know, this is obviously of benefit to our society. These people are going to have these jobs one way or the other, and it's better for them to take modafinil than speed. But on the other hand, that's basically the nature of work. Like, for instance, the exploitation of medical interns, you know, 80-hour shifts and so forth. One of the reasons why we had medical law reform to get their shifts shorter was that they were making medical mistakes because they were so tired. And now with modafinil, well, you can exploit them for 80 hours because it doesn't make a difference. They'll just take modafinil. So there is a problem there.
Not to mention that the military is extremely interested in that.
Yeah, exactly.
they like these guys who can work 48-hour shifts.
Well, they've been putting, soldiers on Dexedrine for 50,
right.
60 years.
And you get, with modafinil, you get all the awake without the psychosis, and it's a much better thing when the guy's got a big gun, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, now the human enhancement stuff that you want to spend the next year writing about human enhancement.
Yeah, well, it all depends on various things that, you know, we really can't talk about right now. I mean, I don't mean to be coy, but, you know.
No, that's fine.
I think that we got what's happening now. One of the reasons that so many particularly conservative people have their shorts in a knot about this enhancement thing is because implicitly or not, they understand that what's really at stake here is what kind of people we're going to be. The definition of what a human is suddenly in play again, in a way that it's been before, because we've had to undo racism and we've had to undo other problems that focus on our sense of what a human is. But it's going to happen again. And I think that the neoconservative agenda is basically an agenda about human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's going to unfold through the most obvious thing so far is the stem cell research ban, which is, when Nancy Reagan is against it, you've really tapped deep into one of the mine shafts of American culture, you know, and there are obviously many, many other problems that are going to be looked at. I think that the steroid issue, especially with the Olympics this mm-hmm. summer, it's going to, and at some point people are going to start to say, well, now wait a minute, what's the difference between steroids and better nutrition?
Right.
What's the difference between steroids and just affluence?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Better living conditions and so on.
Living in a higher climate or...
All this stuff. And they're going to, you know, people are going to start to have to recognize that, well, if we never really tampered, why, we'd all be dead by the time we're 40. You're over 40, I can tell.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you've probably had the eye thing happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably had the dentist thing happen.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Hey, every piece is beginning to go.
We're supposed to be dead. That's why. We've done our thing, you know. So in fact, this notion that we're going to, you know, leave ourselves in our pristine condition, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And these projects of nostalgia are always conservative, obviously, by definition, but actually a little frightening
mm-hmm.
because it's about hearkening back to some lost age that never really happened but has a huge emotional connection to us. So when you look at that part of the argument in the hands of a guy like Bill McKibben,
right,
then you see that it's much more difficult to get a hold of that than it is when it's made by somebody like Leon Cass.
Mm-hmm.
Because McKibben is really arguing that that there's a this kind of fundamental thing called humanity that is at risk or at stake if we allow bioengineered corn.
Right, but isn't this bringing you full circle? Because the Unabomber Manifesto, McKibben's book Enough, is basically the Unabomber Manifesto turned into acceptable prose for his literate audience.
Yeah, and so that's right. You've caught me in this enormous conflict. So what the hell am I talking about?
Well, I don't want to force you on one side or the other. I mean, we can all have complicated views.
For once in my life, I don't have an opinion about something. You know, I have this idea that what we've got here is a major confusion. And that's why I'm really interested in it. There's no easy answer. Now that's a cliche. It boggles the mind to try to figure this out. And I find it really interesting. My major access to the notion that technology is a problem, as I said earlier, is really from drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So I achieve these other states of consciousness in which the world of technology looks absolutely insane, and yet, how did I get there? Well, I'll admit I did some organic drugs too, but you know, the difference in effect between peyote and LSD, it's huge in some ways, but in other ways you achieve a similar state of consciousness. So to say that I've had this insight that there's something really fundamentally wrong at an ontological level with technology, I don't know that I can trust that. I don't know that I can really believe that that should be the basis of anything.
You know, one of the turning points for me was I've been a Buddhist since I was 17. And when Tricycle, the magazine Tricycle, which is a Buddhist journal, first got started, one of the key essays that they published, which was very seminal for my thinking, was called Non-Dual Ecology. And it was basically a critique of the wholehearted embrace of deep ecology, excuse me, by Buddhists, American Buddhists in particular, as some kind of syncretism of paganism and in the environmental concerns and Buddhism. Because what deep ecology said explicitly was that there's this natural order out there, and humanity is somehow violating this natural order, and humanity has to get back in sync with the natural order by limiting its own numbers and so on and so forth. And what the non-dual ecology article argued, what was the guy's name? McClellan, I think, was the author. At any rate, what he argued was that humanity and technology and our products are a part of nature, and that we have to get rid of the dualistic thinking of humanity versus nature and think about how, you know, what it means to actually be synthetically a part of nature. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we can continue to do whatever we're doing, you know, because being fully conscious and present with our interdependence with nature might entail a very different course. But it certainly doesn't mean either having this dualistic version of Manichaean version where humanity is all bad and nature is all good.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You know, you have to sort of, for me, you have to decouple the way that technology seems to lead inevitably to something like global warming,
mm-hmm.
From the way that technology may be a solution to the problem that you call in an article human racism.
Right.
It's very tricky. I'm not sure I know I haven't fully figured that one out, but there's a reason to be deeply suspicious of technology, but the way that it forces us into a kind of Manichaeism that's unacceptable. Intellectually, it just can't work. We can't pretend that, you know, humans are bad and nature is good. That's just a version of original sin, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, you said that you thought that this was an inherently, by the way, I'm speaking with Gary Greenberg. He's a journalist, writes about, bioethical issues and is going to be embarking on some writing about human enhancement in the future, which we're not going to talk about in any detail, but he writes for a number of different magazines, but it comes from a generally progressive point of view. And so the next question is, you note that there is this profoundly conservative, and we sometimes in the transhumanist circles, we talk about bioconservatism, bioludism is another cognate phrase. And And I certainly see it that way, that there is a progressive and conservative dimension to a number of different political issues in the world, and that on the progressive end, transhumanism is progressive. But in the current last 12 years, the context of these ideas has been very different from what they had been for the last 400 years, where the people who were talking about using science and reason and so forth to transcend the boundaries that nature and God had imposed on us were all generally political progressives. In the last 12 years, many of the people who have been attracted to these ideas have been very affluent, highly educated, white male, techno nerds in Silicon Valley, net culture, et cetera, et cetera. And as a consequence, have brought a characteristic set of political baggage with them that has been relatively, economically at any rate, conservative, and not culturally. And so it's created this, what I consider to be an odd and temporary historical dynamic where it's not at all clear that that it's all left-right. You know, there's, as you said, Bill McKibben is from the left, and there are many people on the left who see the idea of any transformations or tampering with human nature as eugenic and so on and so forth. Do you think that this is going to play itself out, that this inherently conservative nature of the idea of preserving humanity and not embracing the diversity of and the self-determination that might get us to that diversity, that this will play itself out so that progressives will eventually come around to seeing that their natural sympathy should be with the transformation side?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question, isn't it? I mean, you look at the way that Leon Cass sounds like a hippie, you know.
Right, exactly.
He starts talking
about... He certainly is not like a hippie, I can tell you that.
No, but when you read the stuff that they've the President's Council sounds like a commune in 1969, you know, in the Berkshires, with their worship of nature and the acceptance of life as it's given. They all sound like they went out and took acid and wrote this thing, which I really doubt happened.
Right.
So this inversion of ideological distinctions is really interesting. Is it going to... And I think you're right that in progressive circles, it remains unquestioned. That is, the important question hasn't been asked yet, which is something like, what does it mean that Bill McKibben and Leon Cass agree?
Mm-hmm.
That's bizarre.
Right.
That shouldn't be. So where is the problem? Is the problem that, in fact, this is the end of history, as another President's Council member would put it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've reached that point where ideology is no longer needed because we can all unite against the bad pharmaceutical companies and against the bad transhumanists. I don't think so. I think we're going to muddle through. I mean, I think that's basically what happens, right? There's mm-hmm. going to be a kind of muddling through, and what I hope is that the left can become more aware of the need to question its own resistance to technological advance, biotechnological advance, even as it struggles to figure out how enhancement and related technologies can be limited. Because I'm not sure that it's fair to talk about it and say, okay, well, let's just let it rip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, let's let it rip and see what happens.
Because a lot of risks here.
There are a lot of risks. And I know that you have this idea of citizenship as cyborg citizenship, which I haven't read yet. So I'll defer judgment on that.
You get an advance copy, I'll tell you that. Well, yeah, I mean, the argument I make in Citizen Cyborg is that these technologies have to be tested for safety, and then there's an enormous room for debate about what it really means to determine that something is safe, which kinds of risks are we going to determine, how long do we have to determine it, and which bodies and so forth. And then they have to be as much as possible, and then there's an enormous debate there, made universally available so that we minimize the risks of a bifurcation of society into the haves and have-nots around these technologies, which could much more qualitatively and quantitatively create inequality than even our current situation.
Of course, if you couldn't achieve that, the way to do them would be to distribute them more to the people who have less.
That's true, a preferential option for the poor. That seems like even a farther shot than trying to have universal.
You think so, huh?
Yeah. But no, I talk in the book about the struggle for universal health care. I mean, it's it continues to be outrageous that the United States doesn't have universal health care. And right now, not having access to health insurance probably cuts about 5 years off your life expectancy. In about 10 or 15 years, it may cut 50 years off your life expectancy. So I think it will change the political dynamic around these questions of equity really profound ways. And I think the conservatives see that as well.
Yeah. So what you're saying, I think, is that as these debates advance, what's going to come closer, more and more into focus, is the way that they are inevitably questions about selfhood. What kind of people are we going to be? And that's an inescapably political question.
Right.
And so more, all the more reason that, you know, the progressive side of the ideological spectrum needs to become hip to these issues.
Exactly.
And not settle for this sort of overweening nostalgia. It just, that's not going to work.
Gary, it's been a real delight talking to you.
Well, this has been fun.
And I look forward to coming back and doing this again, since you're going to have some free time in the coming year to do it.
Let's hope.
Thanks so much. I've been speaking with Gary Greenberg. He's a journalist here in Connecticut. He writes about human enhancement, Prozac. There are many of his articles online. And we will have him back as a guest. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
You can hear the first half of that interview with Gary Greenberg at changesurfer.com. Stay tuned for the first half of an interview with Are You Serious?, the editor of Neophiles. I'm speaking today with Are You Serious? Are You is a longtime activist and editor and media content producer in the world of psychedelic futurism and transhumanism, and the former editor of Mondo 2000. Welcome, Are You.
Thank you.
I used to subscribe to Mondo 2000. I think it was one of my first tastes of this brand of psychedelic futurism. And I wanted to start back there. Of course, you can start before there. But tell me, how did you get, what was the trajectory that led to the founding of Mondo, and what was its initial mission?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the trajectory was probably dropping about 500 mics a couple of days after John Lennon was shot. And
micrograms of LSD, you're talking
yes,
about.
And that came in tandem with the fact that I'd been reading a lot of Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson. And somehow, on an almost mystical level, I felt compelled, you know, one of those, what Leary might call a DNA compulsion, come out to California and sort of start the psychedelic slash science slash tech slash, you know, anarchism thing. Of course, I say started. Of course, it was already happening here, but this was the sense that I had, that I was going out there to move this thing along. I started a magazine called High Frontiers, which focused mostly on psychedelics and had the tech and science as a background phenomena. And eventually, as we, and I say we, I include Allison Kennedy, a.k.a. Queen Moo, and a bunch of other people, eventually we decided to sort of reverse fields. You know, we could see this thing coming up, this technoculture coming up, and it became pretty obvious to us that that was a place to focus our literary and publishing energies. And part of that was what I found really intriguing while we were doing High Frontiers was so much of our response was coming to people from Silicon Valley. And we would go to parties and we would meet a lot of the main people who were designing the software and the hardware, and working on all the stuff that was creating the next economy. And so I thought it was very interesting that these people were High Frontiers fans of this neo-psychedelic magazine. So you could feel this ferment, you know, this cultural ferment going on, and this sort of deep intelligence background behind the creation of the computer culture that certainly people weren't talking about. It wasn't very much in the interests of people at Apple or people designing software to herald themselves as psychedelic veterans or people with countercultural sensibilities. But you know, once somebody prompted them to talk about it, they weren't shy about talking about it.
And yet, already in the 80s, there was a beginning of an appropriation of some of the psychedelic culture for commercial purposes, like that Apple ad at the 1984 ad.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it all came out of that, you know, trying to touch back to people in a non-threatening way, touch back on those themes.
Well, I mean, there was definitely the notion that the personal computer was a great equalizer and that, you know, it would give individuals the power to communicate, you know, in the public sphere that had previously been vouchsafed mostly to large corporations, although, you know, obviously one could, you know, print an underground newspaper or something like that. But, I mean, it was an authentic vision, I think. I mean, I still think it's had a tremendous democratizing impact. And, you know, I can still rummage around on the web and go from cyborg democracy to the Extropians to commondreams.com and AltNet and all these things that are really pretty vital. So you know, I honor that that vision.
Well, it's very interesting because there was a technology connection from the very beginning in some of those Timothy Leary type circles. Timothy Leary had his famous Smile 2 vision,
right,
that somehow space exploration and all kinds of things would be hooked up with a psychedelic revolution. So,
right.
Although the Extropians and people like them tend to portray everything as having started in the mid 80s or late 80s, it really was implicit in a lot of the things that was happening back there in the 70s as well.
Yeah, no, well, I actually just interviewed Max Moore for the upcoming issue of Neophiles, and he acknowledges both Wilson and Leary as early influences.
It's interesting, though, because one of the things about Wilson and Leary, and I saw recently you interviewed Richard Metzger from Disinformation on your new project, Neophiles, which we'll talk about in a second.
Right.
There's this occult and spiritual edge to some of that stuff that some of these hardcore contemporary transhumanists who are atheists and secularists and rationalists have a hard time with. So do you see that as one of the kind of latent tensions in all of this, or one of the latent transitions from an openness to spiritual inquiry and self-transformation to more of a hardcore rationalism?
Well, I mean, I think, and this also came up in the discussion with Moore and came up in a sense in the discussion with Metzger on the site as well. In some sense, the use of science and technology is a sort of hard-headed realization, particularly as viewed through things like transhumanism, of some of the goals of magic and of alchemy and so forth. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think that a lot of, you know, hardcore, quote, rationalists, unquote, like to create this really rigid boundary, but when you press them on it, that boundary sometimes tends to disappear, or at least they honor the fact that in previous decades, in previous generations, people who were exploring for new edges and expanded human possibilities might have used occult or quote spiritual unquote means as sort of the only possible avenue, the only potential avenue for getting beyond you know, ordinary humanness. So, I mean, for myself, I think rationalism, I mean, even in terms of what we're understanding about how the brain functions, I think rationalism is a very important part of a larger gestalt that where the brain really works by, in simple terms, what can be called an intuitive process. And, of course, the whole aha notion in science has long been talked about. And, you know, you can sit around and think about a problem for an awfully long time, and then, you know, you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning and the solution is there. Or I know people who have designed complex software programs in an acid trance. And generally, I mean, when you're on acid, you know, you're not very good at playing chess or whatever. But these, you know, there are some things that are not explicable by simple, you know, Boolean logic or that sort of thing, certainly.
I know that you're an advocate of ending the drug war, and of course it's consistent with your last 20 years of advocacy. But now that you're looking towards, and this is kind of a tangent to our discussion about your own intellectual trajectory, but it raises in this context, now that you have spent all this time thinking about these things and you're looking forward to the kind of psychopharmaceuticals we have in the future, have you become, are there any possibilities in the sphere of psychopharmaceuticals that you're more anxious about than you would have been in the past? You know, potential forms of addiction, potential forms of self modification that you think we should be more worried about than are more libertarian about?
Well, I mean, I think it's always, there's always some value in being worried, and there's always some value in, you know, particularly in being concerned that drugs can be used to more or less brainwash people, to make people too easily receptive to particular messages. So, I mean, in combination with an authoritarian culture, which can be either government authoritarianism or commercial, you know, commercial authoritarianism pushing, or the combination of the two that we have today. Yeah, certainly there's some danger there.
Check back next week for the second half of this interview with Are You Serious, editor of Neophiles. This is Dr. J of Change Surfer Radio, reading All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace by Richard Brautigan. I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony, like pure water touching clear sky. I like to think, right now please, of a cybernetic forest filled with pines and electronics, where deer stroll peacefully past computers as if they were flowers with spinning blossoms. I like to think, it has to be, of a cybernetic ecology, where we are free of our labors and joined back to nature, returned to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace. All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace by Richard Brautigan. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.